once again, thank you for coming. And that was about the coolest thing. I told you there would be a night to remember, and we'll always remember that. We are always told that the newcomer is the most important person in the room. And with that being said, I've got a newcomer from Ohio that's been around for a long, long time, and he'll tell you what being a newcomer is and how he always starts the story. And Mel Barger from Toledo, Ohio.
Thank you, Harmon. My name is Mel Barger. I'm an alcoholic. And I see this was supposed to be over at 9, so I only have 2 minutes.
They made a cake for me and
Joan, who was 50 years in Al-Anon, I guess. Joan, somewhere there. And they lighted the candles. And I believe the candles set off that fire alarm. I noticed the place was packed when we left, and I see a few empty seats. So whoever you are, to heck with you. But it really is delightful to be here. You know, I didn't even know I was supposed to be here, and a couple months ago somebody called and said that they had received a flyer that I was going to be in Levittown, and I don't even remember, and I've been sober 62 years tomorrow, and it just so happened that this would be on the eve of my anniversary. Now, we're visiting our son over in Sleepy Hollow, just north of Manhattan, and he's got a month-old daughter and a 2-year-old boy, and my wife is with them. Otherwise, she would be here to hear my talk for the 500th time. And I was in AA 10 years before I ever got married. And I remember my wife's parents didn't like the fact that I was in AA. But her sister was married to a guy who made me look pretty good later on. I shouldn't say that because they're both gone now. But I met my wife. I was living in Jackson, Michigan, and one of the things that sobriety gave for me was I became an amateur actor, and I was doing the part of Sebastian in The Great Sebastians. And there was one scene where Sebastian goes across the stage in his underwear. And she was watching that show, and she saw me and said, "I've got to have that man." It was something along that line. Now, the flyer also said that I was the author of Pass It On. I would like to clear that up a little bit. I did work on Pass It On for 2 years, but there were probably 3 or 4 authors, and I've always just said that I was a contributing writer to Pass It On. I wrote 2 manuscripts. I started on it, I think, around 1980 and finished my... Well, they fired me 2 years later. This is apparently seems to be one of the ways that you work with the GSO, with the AA World Publishing, and some of them that you, everybody starts with smiles and everything else, and sometimes it ends with a little bit of resentment. I don't have any resentment because that project really turned out to be great. I think I wrote about half of what is now published as Pass It On. I guess that's respectable. And I also spent 2 weekends at Stepping Stones when Lois was still living, and I got to know Lois quite well, and also Nell Wing. And is Gail still here? did she run off with the fire department? Gail got started on archives work a lot with Nell Wing, and I got to know Nell Wing very well. In fact, I've written something about Nell that's going to be published in a publication they send out called Box 459. And she's just got a great story in herself, a non-alcoholic who fell in love with AA, went to work at GSO on a temporary basis. It was temporary. She only stayed there 36 years. And she, even though she was a non-alcoholic, she just became like an AA member herself with her thinking and the way she worked, helped Bill set up the archives later on after Bill passed on. It was really something. Well, AA, what we really do in AA is tell our stories, and we're supposed to do that, but I won't bother you with much of my drinking story tonight except to say that I was 24 years old when I finally took my last drink. And 62 years ago tonight, I would have been living with my mother and stepdad in Norfolk, Nebraska, where I grew up, northeast Nebraska. And I'd brought home, I'd been drinking for 8 or 10 days, and I brought home a sack of beer, either cans or bottles of Pabst Blue Ribbon. And I guess I liked Pabst Blue Ribbon the best because I didn't think you wet the bed as much when you drank it. And I was really on thin ice with my mother and stepdad. I would have been on the street if I hadn't been just living with them. And that had been my life in the last few years. But I had come into AA about a year and a half before that, when I was 23 years old, went to my first meeting in Santa Paula, California. I was living in Ventura, about 10 miles away. And something about that first meeting, or my first introduction to AA, really got me started, I guess, on AA history. Because the second AA member I met was one of the first 2,000 members. And a few minutes later, I met his son-in-law, who was one of the first 200 members. These were people who had moved out to California from Akron. And the kind of AA that they had there seemed to follow what they did in Akron, where everybody kind of talked a little bit, and the women sat on one side of the room, but even the wives took a part in it. And the wife of one of these members even gave me the big book to read, which I thought, later on, I thought that was kind of risky, because I didn't usually loan people the big book after that because I hardly ever got them back. But anyway, that was kind of my start in AA. And my drinking, even though I was only 23, a month after my 23rd birthday when I went to my first meeting, I'd already been through the mill. I looked back, and I guess I was just one of these people who had the bug, and all it took was to get introduced in a big way to alcohol, and I was a goner. I didn't believe at first in what the AA said about AA alcoholism being an obsession of the mind and allergy of the body. I didn't believe in this allergy business, that there was any physical thing about it, but I came to believe that. I believe today that alcoholics are people who never should have had one drink. There was something there. All you needed was exposure to alcohol and a little bit of drinking experience, and before long you were a goner. I believe that's what Dr. Silkworth said and what he wrote in the first part of the big book. But I stayed sober 5-6 months after my first introduction to AA, and then I went back to drinking. And then I stayed sober 3 months kind of on my own, and then finally wound up back in my hometown in Nebraska, which is in northeast part of the state. It was a town of about 30,000, I guess. And living with my mother and stepdad, and really a kind of a demeaning existence where I was hardly anybody spoke to me anymore, and I would walk down the street and see somebody I'd gone to school with and not even say hello to them. I'd reached a shameful existence. But I'd come home that night with this Pabst Blue Ribbon, and the next day a neighbor lady that I didn't even get along with very well came over and talked me into going out to the state hospital, which was on a hill overlooking the town. And I had grown up always hearing about the Nut House, you know, the insane asylum up there, and I wound up there myself. But I stayed there 7 weeks, but that can of Pabst Blue Ribbon, that was my last drink, and that was 62 years ago, tomorrow morning. And You know, many years later, I was walking across the parking lot, and a beer truck almost ran me down, and I saw on the side of it, it said Pabst Blue Ribbon. I thought, God, they're still trying to get me. things just started to turn for the better. I got back into AA when I was in the state hospital and started going to meetings again, and everything just started to click. I really, I think, accepted the first step, which probably I hadn't been fully committed to it when those months that I'd stayed sober before that. And it has stuck with me ever since. I stayed around Nebraska for a few months and then moved out to Pontiac, Michigan, where I had some relatives that owned a machine shop, and I worked with them, and then moved to Detroit for a while. And it seemed to me then, in 1950 and 51, that AA had gotten to be about as big as it could be, that it seemed to me that we had a group in almost every block in Detroit. We didn't, of course, but we just had a lot of AA around there. I remember one of the guys told me that I shouldn't go out to Michigan because nobody would pay any attention to me. There'd be a big group there, and actually I wound up making some of the best friends I ever had. And I got to know people that I knew that stayed sober 30, 40, 50 years. And there's a lot of staying power in AA. It seems like a lot of people come in and go out. We have a revolving door. But there are people that stay sober for years and stay with the program. I could walk around cemeteries around Detroit and Pontiac and Toledo and see people that I'm very grateful to that stayed sober all their lives. This program works if you're really committed to it, except the fact that you're an alcoholic and are willing to do anything you can to stay sober. And it doesn't really require too much. You just go to a lot of meetings and try to live the right kind of life and clean up some of the old things. I've cleaned up at least 10% of my bad habits. And doing what they say in AA, and it has worked. It works very well. I'm 86 now, 86 and a half. Well, 86 and three-fourths. And I have four adult children and 10 grandchildren. As I think I mentioned, that we have a month-old granddaughter with my son and his wife. They live over in Sleepy Hollow, New York. And my son, youngest son, in fact, drove me over here tonight, and he was supposed to meet me here at 9. I hope that he didn't drive by and see the crowd and then drive on home. If not, I hope somebody will give me a ride. But anyway, what I did want to mention, though, it said that I was the author of Pass It On, and I was one of probably five authors. Everybody seems, when you do this work for GSO, everybody seems to stick their nose into it and think that they can do it better than you did. For example, some years ago, I think they tried to write a history of AA, and they tried to get it through the General Service Conference, and they finally had to shelve it. Everybody read it, and all of these delegates read it. Nobody liked what they had said about his section or something like that, and I think they shelved the project after spending all that money on it. So then if there's going to be any history of AA, it's going to be these guys like myself that write this, write that. I've got my books on the Internet now and my articles. They're all there on the Internet. And if you just put my name on Google, and something will come up. In fact, maybe some things will come up that I don't want coming up. But I did, after I worked on Pass It On, I wanted to call that book Bill W. and His Friends, and I wanted a handshake on the cover. Well, none of that got followed. But after that, I'd worked on it for 2 years, and the people I'd interviewed and the experience that gave me enough information that I did some books of my own, which were published by Hazelden. And I think I have 12 or 13 publications out, and some of them in pamphlet form. And this is just information I picked up interviewing some of these old-timers. And some of them told me that things that they probably didn't want anybody to know. But well, anyway, that's quite a long story, and I tried to, everything I wrote, though, and I never would publish anything that I would think would be harmful to AA or would be hurtful to anybody trying to stay sober. Everything I've written, I'm confident today it's positive. I have one book called Walk in Dry Places, which is a daily meditation book, and my wife and I use it every morning ourselves, and long before I got it published, we were using it in the manuscript form. And then one called New Wine, and that's about the spiritual roots of AA, and talk about the Oxford group, some of the things that Gail discussed here. She touched on a lot of the things that I wanted to talk about. Did Gail leave? Is she here? There you are. I feel a little proprietary about Gail because I've known her for 25 or 30 years, and I think I helped her get started a little bit in the archives work. Isn't that right? She's nodding her head. Gail was a school teacher with the Akron school system. And in fact, one of her bosses helped my oldest son get a scholarship at Kent State. And so I have a lot of ties over there in various ways. And when she was first getting into archives work, she really was wanting, she would have liked being the archivist in New York, you know, the big job there, and the one that Nell Wing eventually filled. And then later on when she retired and the job came open, I told her, gosh, why don't you go to New York and get that job? And she says, well, it would cost too much to live there. And I said, well, you could get some rich guy to put you up. But that never worked out that way. But, she's going to be mad at me for saying that. Well, anyway, working on Pass It On was a great experience because I got to interview some of these old-timers, these people who were still living. You know, when they decided to write biographies of the co-founders, now when I went to my first meetings out in Ventura and Santa Paula, California, they referred to Bill as the founder of AA and Dr. Bob as the co-founder. And it was a little later that they started referring to him as co-founders, and I think that was Bill's doing. I think Bill had a little problem with people out in Akron and Cleveland. There was a lot of resentment toward him. And once you start doing some research on this, you find that out pretty fast. And I think he did this in an effort to show that Dr. Bob was just as important in the founding of AA as he was. But nevertheless, Bill was really the architect of AA, the guy who did most of the writing and whose vision really prevailed. One of the old-timers told me that when AA had left just a few hundred members, Bill would set one of their meetings in New York and talk about the fellowship as if it had thousands or even millions. He had that vision. And I think Dr. Bob would have acknowledged that. Dr. Bob never took credit for any of the 12 steps or anything like that. He was a very humble man, and he knew that. But his great job was starting AA in Akron or getting it really going. Akron was far more successful in attracting members and having a lot of sober people when New York was kind of stumbling, really. I think Dr. Bob was a much better sponsor than Bill, even though Bill was the guy with this amazing vision and concept of what AA could become. But anyway, I had right from the very start, after meeting these first people from Akron who lived out in the California area, started getting interested in the history of AA. And even when I went back to drinking, I was still interested in that. I would even go down to the library and read a little bit and so on. But one time I got drunk and called Dr. Bob. I was kind of ashamed of that later on because he was dying. And I never told many people about it. But I also knew some of these other founders, the guy who started AA in Cleveland, who didn't like Bill very well. And the some of the people that Gail mentioned. And of course, in Detroit was one of the very early big cities to break out. We had a guy named Mike E. in Detroit who was a tremendous guy. I would go hear him several times. I was interested in these people who'd gotten AA started and their views. But one thing I also discovered is that they're just like the rest of us. They had the same problems we have in our groups, you know, where people are jealous of each other, and once in a while somebody runs around to somebody else's wife. That doesn't happen very often, but that kind of thing. But that was going on when AA first got started. And as far as honoring the founders, I don't think Bill or Bob, either one, wanted the kind of honors we give them today. I don't think Dr. Bob I wanted his house to become a shrine, which it really is. And Bill, Stepping Stones, is also, I guess you would call it a shrine. Bill didn't even want his biography written. The one thing he did was he holed up in a hotel with a writer, and for a couple of days he delivered his story. I think we call it now the Bedford Manuscripts or something, because they used the Bedford Hotel, where he told his part of the story, and that's been published in one form or another. Well, there have been a number of books published now about Bill, and some of them haven't been very complimentary in some ways. But I think my feeling today is that Bill was just one of the greatest men of the 20th century. When I moved out to Pontiac, one of the members there asked me if I knew who Norman Vincent Peale was. Now, this was before The Power of Positive Thinking had been published. And I said, yes, I did. I knew of his books. And the guy said, well, he heard Norman Vincent Peale say in New York that Bill would be looked upon as one of the great men of the 20th century, something along that line. Well, some years later, I met Peale and spent a couple of days at one of his retreats in New York, and I asked him if he had said that, and he said, oh, yes. He said, I still think so today. And by gosh, maybe a month or two or a year or two later, Life magazine and I believe Time magazine came out with a list of the 100 greatest Americans, something like that, and there was Bill. He was people have come to acknowledge that Bill did have a unique role in founding AA, and but just reading his, I've read everything he wrote, and I just see the greatness in him. There was in one of my books, gosh, I always get bawled out for bragging about my own books up here. Fellow did that when I spoke over in Canada one day, and he thanked me for coming and then bawled me out for mentioning my own books. And a couple of the members from Canada wrote to apologize for the way he had criticized me, and a couple others wrote to say they agreed with him. But anyway, Bill, I've worked for a company in Jackson, Michigan. The president of the company had very unique ideas about what people accomplish and what they're capable of accomplishing. And he always felt that if you could find out what people are capable of doing and like to do and could put all their talents together in the right way, why, you could get good performance out of people. And that's how he ran the company. And he would never hire a salesman that was afraid of meeting people or something like that. And one of the ideas, for example, was that a person could be a second-rate writer and a second-rate engineer, but he could be a first-rate technical writer when you put those two things together. He might be second-rate in one area. Well, Bill, I think, had about seven areas that maybe wasn't the most outstanding guy in that area, but he was good. One of them, he was the kind of guy that wanted to fix things. I believe Bill, if he had seen you stalled on the highway, he would have stopped right away to help you. When a problem needed fixing, I believe Bill was the kind of guy that wanted to do it, no matter what the problem was, and that right away when he found the answer to alcoholism for himself, he wanted to pass it on to other people. I think he was also entrepreneurial. That this was reflected in the way he got AA started. He really had wanted to use his entrepreneurial abilities in business to make some money. This was in his background on Wall Street and so on. But it got applied in AA. He was also a good communicator. A funny thing about Bill is he wrote such nice stuff, but he didn't read much. I guess he did. Lois did most of the reading. She would read aloud to Bill. But Ernie Kurtz, one of the fellows who wrote A Good History of AA, he said Bill was a great listener. When people would tell him something or he would hear something, he just had an ability to listen to that ability that a lot of us don't have. And he was kind of a statesman-like person, you know, the way he kind of stood apart and just the way he withdrew himself from AA and handled himself, there was something statesmanlike. And there were several other areas that he was just, these are covered in a book I wrote titled The Search for Bill W. In 1951, I had been living in Detroit or in Pontiac, Michigan for about a year and was sober now almost a year. And Bill came out to Detroit to talk about what he called the third legacy. Now, Bill had a talent for kind of giving special names to people or things he wanted to do. And he called the General Service Conference the third legacy. He was promoting the General Service Conference. And there were three things that we supposedly had received from the founders. One of them was recovery and unity, but the third legacy was service. And he was promoting the General Service Conference. Dr. Bob had died the previous November. And so he went all over the North America, Canada, and the U.S. talking at large gatherings. He would have had this whole auditorium filled that night in Detroit. And I went down to Detroit with some members of AA and Pontiac and to hear Bill talk about the third legacy. He talked for 2 hours, an hour, and then we broke for a cigarette. You could smoke then in the building. And then he talked another hour, but it was all promoting the General Service Conference. And this was the first time I ever heard Bill talk. And, you know, I expected to see some guy that was really dazzling, you know, like one of these hucksters, you know, but Bill was not a huckster or anything like that. He just talked in a matter of fact. Well, actually, the way he talked and answering Gail's questions, pretty nice of Bill to show up here tonight, wasn't it? And I guess I was a little disappointed. And then another bad thing, I was living with these relatives, and where I had been kicked out of hotels for drunk, being drunk and maybe wetting the bed or something like that, I was wearing myself out with these relatives for living in their house and coming in late from AA meetings. And I think when I came back that night, it was real late, and I upset them again. And I moved out shortly after that, but I stayed on good terms with them for the rest of their lives. And I also learned that anybody who's helped you, try to be grateful to them if they've helped you in any way, even if they became critical of you later on. If they helped you at one time and then kind of betrayed you another time, we should still be grateful for any help that they gave us. Some months ago, I went to a church where they were having a Gratitude Sunday, and they passed a microphone around and asked us what to be grateful for. And I said, I'm grateful for my wife of 50 years and also for the two or three women who dumped me before I met her. Anyway, that was the first time I heard Bill talk. And then in 56, I went over to Founders Day in Akron. At that time, they only had it one day. It's now kind of covers a weekend. And it was still kind of small in 56. And Bill talked on the Saturday night at a place, I think it was called the Goodyear Auditorium or something like that. And I went up to him afterwards and told him that I was living in Jackson, Michigan, where I lived for 19 years, by the way. And Bill, right just like that, he said, "Well, my memory of Jackson goes back to Al Cameron's time." Now, that was the guy who had started AA in Jackson. And you see, Bill, even though he had a bad memory about some things, like dates and figures and things like that, there were some things that he was very sharp with. And that kind of startled me that he had remembered this fellow who had started AA in Jackson. It was one of the first AA members. I think Al Cameron went back to 1939. Anyway, today I have that man's big book, which was given to me later on by the group in Jackson, Michigan. But Bill said he didn't have to. I said I'd like to talk to him a little bit, but he said just send him a letter. And so I got back to Jackson, and I sent a letter asking him some questions about his spiritual experience and that sort of thing. And by gosh, I got a 3 or 4 page letter from him. And he told me all about his experience and what he considered the roots of it, and then also about his depressions, his long struggle with depression. And, you know, that really kind of pissed me off. Bill didn't have any right to be depressed. We found out later that that was one of his problems, that he suffered quite a bit from depression. Gail mentioned it in her talk. And it was something he struggled with most of his life. But the way he dealt with it was to be honest with it and to share it with the rest of us, to tell us he wasn't perfect. He wasn't this guy with the knight in shining armor or anything like that. He had the same problems the rest of us had. And I later started to treasure this letter. And then later on, I had an idea in the back of my mind that I would like to write about Bill. I had become a company magazine editor. I worked for a company in Jackson. They had what was called an external company magazine. It went out to about 40,000 people. And so I had developed some skills along the in writing, a little bit in editing, and this kind of thing. And I always thought I wanted to write something about Bill. And then they did Dr. Bob's biography when they decided to do they decided that the reason to do Dr. Bob's biography was that there were a lot of people still living who had known Dr. Bob, and they could get a lot of material by interviewing those people, whereas with Bill, they had his own writings and other information that they could work from. So they did Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers first. And a short time later, they started on Bill's biography. Well, they hired a fellow named Niles Peebles to write the Dr. Bob biography. And I was a little jealous of Niles having this job. And then a short time later, they started on Bill's biography, and they gave Niles that assignment. And I was even more jealous of him. And then a couple months later, Niles died. Now, I had nothing to do with that. I had nothing to do with that. But I immediately went down to New York and threw my hat in the ring. And I picked up interviews Niles had made and some of the stuff he had written so far. And so I worked on that for the next 2 years. Now, in the meantime, I was employed in public relations by the Libby Owens Ford Company, the glass company in Toledo. So I had to do this in my spare time and using vacation days and this kind of thing. But it turned out to be a wonderful project from learning more about AA and how it got started and the people. Many of the old-timers were still living, you know, and had their memories. But one of the most memorable things was spending 2 weekends at Stepping Stones with Lois, and Nell Wing also had come up. Now, Nell Wing, after Bill died, Nell Wing had become very close to Bill and Lois during Bill's lifetime. And then after Bill died, Nell would spend every other weekend with Lois up in Stepping Stone. She was just like a daughter to Lois, no question about it. She worried about Lois all the time, was like a guardian to Lois. Well, I went down to New York to get started, and I called Lois up, and she invited me to come out to Stepping Stones. This was probably on a Thursday, so I got out there the next day. Now, Stepping Stones is about 30 miles north of Manhattan. It's an easy train ride up there. In fact, where my son lives today is only a few miles from there. And I got there, and a woman named Edna was staying there. And Edna didn't look good at all. She looked very underweight, but I didn't know who she was. I thought maybe she was an Al-Anon member or somebody who knew Lois for some other reason. But anyway, I spent the weekend there with Lois and interviewing Lois, and Edna sat in on our interviews, seemed very interested in them. And Edna was seen to be the type of person that she just wanted to do something to be helpful. If you got a cup dirty, why, she'd rush over and wash it and that kind of thing. Well, then on Monday, a man came to pick Edna up, and I learned that she was a woman who had worked for Lois some years before as a housekeeper, and she had been working for another family in Westchester. Now, there are a lot of rich people up in that area. And she had been working for them as a housekeeper, and then she had gotten sick and gone to the hospital. And they had told her at the hospital that she was terminal, and she had no place to stay. The poor woman was practically destitute, and she had no home, nobody to go to or anything. And the people she had worked for wouldn't let her come back and stay in her bedroom in their home. Well, she was no use to them anymore. She couldn't work too much. And in desperation, she called up Lois and told her what her situation was. And Lois said, come on over and stay with me. And so Edna, this poor destitute woman, had been staying with Lois for several weeks before I got there. And, you know, when I learned the full story, and when I went back and told people in Toledo about it, about Lois's kindness in reaching out to this poor woman, I'd break down and cry, it just seemed to me. Well, that's the type of person Lois was. She was a person, I would say that she had a tough way of presenting herself at times, but she was a woman with a wonderful big heart. And I have a PowerPoint program about the development of AA. And to me, the four founders of AA were Bill and Dr. Bob, but also Lois and Bill's wife, and then Ann Smith, who is Dr. Bob's wife, of course. You came in here tonight, Dr. Bob's picture was there and Ann's picture. These wives and people like Lois just really had a lot to do with. Lois had really kept Bill going when he was not doing well at all. But this story about Edna was really got to me. And then a couple months later, I was talking to Lois, and she told me Edna had died. But there was a case of a woman who was just desperate and no place to go and everything. And Lois said, just come and stay with me. That's the type of person she was. So when you see anybody giving credit to Lois or to Ann, why, they deserved it, any credit they got. And I never knew Dr. Bob, but I did get to know Smitty, his son. We have a son down in Texas, and we go down there every Memorial Day for the Gathering of the Eagles. I call it the Gathering of Eagles. But I got to know Smitty quite well. And Smitty told me a few things about when Bill was staying with them in the summer of 1935, when he had gone out there. And Dr. Bob had gone down to New York on a medical convention in Atlantic City and come back drunk. And he was too ashamed to go home, so he had gone to some friend's house. And Lois... And by this time, Bill was living with Dr. Bob and Ann, and Bill learned that Dr. Bob was drunk. Well, he said, Smitty told us, that Bill had packed his bags and was going to go back to New York. You know, Dr. Bob, it seemed like they were doing so well, and then he went down to this medical convention. He comes back drunk. Well, Bill had had 6 months with people, working with people who seemed promising, and then they got drunk. So this seemed to be just another one. But Ann talked him into staying. Let's give it another try. And that's what happened. The story, what Dr. Bill helped Dr. Bob sober up, and Dr. Bob had to perform a surgery. Now, you know, Bill dramatized things a lot. He talked about that surgery that he took Dr. Bob to the hospital and gave him a bottle of beer to steady his hands. And then he said later, the patient lived, you know. And, well, who in the hell ever died from a hemorrhoid operation? But anyway, Dr. Bob did stay sober then from that time on. But the part that Ann played, getting Bill to stay and to continue to work with Dr. Bob, that interested me. I used to call Henrietta Seiberling on the phone. I never met her in person, but she was the woman who introduced Bill and Dr. Bob. You know, the woman, she was living in the gatehouse of Stan Hewitt, which was the Seiberling Mansion there in Akron. You can still tour that mansion today if you want to go there and pay the fee. It's, I think, a 55 or 60-room mansion. The Seiberlings were a very wealthy family at one time. Her father-in-law had founded Goodyear, the Goodyear Corporation, and then had lost control of it in the early 30s or 20s, and then later on founded the Seiberling Tire Company, and the family finally lost control of that a few years ago. But Henrietta was having trouble with her husband. He was something of a philanderer, and she was living out in this gatehouse, and she had found answers to her own problems in the Oxford Group, and that had been very important to her. And this is how she happened to be out there, and she was the person that introduced Bill and Dr. Bob on that Mother's Day afternoon. But one thing that we learned was that Dr. Bob had admitted that he had a drinking problem only a few weeks before Bill called. Now, Dr. Bob had been going to these Oxford Group meetings for 2.5 years, and he insisted that he knew more about the Oxford Group program than Bill did, but he didn't understand alcoholism the way Bill learned it from Dr. Silkworth and his own experience. And I'm having a senior moment here. I hope you'll forgive me. But his admitting, Gail mentioned how Henrietta had this special meeting and got everybody to admit some of their secrets, that kind of thing. And Dr. Bob came out and said, well, this may cost me my profession, but I'm a secret drinker. Well, he was a secret drinker only to himself because everybody knew that. But if he hadn't made that admission, and that was only a few weeks before Bill called, why, Henrietta wouldn't have had the right to call Ann and say, I have somebody to help Bob. See, you can't just call somebody up if they haven't made an admission. We know that in AA. We can't just go up to people who haven't have a drinking problem and say, hey, you're a drunk and I'm here to help you. Well, that was the same thing with Dr. Bob. But Henrietta, because he had admitted that, why, Henrietta had the right to do that. And, of course, we know what happened and the outcome. I always tell people that Dr. Bob was operated on a part of the body that gets very little sunlight. He was a, what did she say he was? What's that? Yeah, we have a guy in our group who is a podiatrist, and he comes to the noon meetings, and sometimes I feel sorry for him that he has to go back to his office and work with people who have smelly feet. Then I start to think, well, what did Dr. Bob have to deal with? So Well, here it's getting close to 10 o'clock. I was going to talk longer, and I was at the conference in San Antonio a couple years ago. We all remember that. And they asked me to speak at a large group in the afternoon. And I got two things that I do. One of them is I have a limerick that describes my drinking history. It goes like, a fearful young man from Nebraska drank amounts that would surely aghast you. He'd take any old slop and drink till he'd drop and finally fell on his aska. And then I also have a song that's a tribute to Dr. Bob and Bill. Well, the lady who was running this big meeting, she was from the General Service offices, and I think she was kind of a control freak. And when she introduced me, she said, "Well, you can sing your song, but you can't repeat your limerick." Well, that just seemed kind of overbearing to me. And we're kind of resourceful. You know, we have to be resourceful to keep drinking. And it occurred to me that if I did my song first and then just finished with my limerick, which was real short, I'd be done before she could stop me. And so I sang my song first, and then I finished with my limerick. Well, she couldn't stop me, but she seemed pretty mad when she left that place. So I would like to finish with my song, if I may. Does anybody want to hear it? I heard this tune up in Canada some years. Well, the song came from Canada, and it was called The Song for the Myra. And then I was going to sing it at our talent show in Toledo. It's called a variety show. We used to call it the talent show, and we discovered nobody had any talent. So we changed it to the variety show. Incidentally, I've lived in Toledo 40 years now, and I've always lived in places that people made fun of. The town I lived in Nebraska, they made fun of it because of that state hospital where I spent 7 weeks. And then Jackson, Michigan, I lived there 19 years and was an AA, active in AA all that time. They made fun of Jackson because we had the big state prison just north of town, you know. And then Toledo, I don't know why people make fun of Toledo, but they had a contest up in Minnesota, and the first prize was a week in Toledo, and the second prize was 2 weeks in Toledo. But I've loved Toledo. It's been a great town for me, and I've loved the AA there. I go to a meeting now that I'm old and retired, and I go to a meeting almost every day, and that's really about the only recreation I get. I don't golf or bowl, and Viagra doesn't work for me. So anyway, I would like to close with my song called Once There Were Founders. Now, I had an operation not long ago, and my thyroid removed. Anybody want to use thyroid? I've got one. And so I started out singing like Mario Lanza, but now I'm down to Johnny Cash with three notes. But Johnny, look what Johnny did with his three notes. Wonderful, weren't they? And this goes... Once there were founders, two men we esteem. They had a vision, a sort of a dream. And though they had struggles, they'd never complain. I wish they were with us again. Once there was darkness, no answer was known. Each of us faced a grim future alone. Then came their vision, and new life appeared. Our founders were with us back then. Can you imagine their place in the universe, higher than princes or kings? They opened the gates to a new way of life and all of the wonder it brings. Once there were founders. We honor them still. a doctor named Bob and a broker named Bill. Dim was the path when their journey began. I wish they were with us again. And over the long years, their stories were told, and lost souls began to return to the fold. All that they told us turned out to be true. Our founders were with us back then. Can you imagine their place in the universe, higher than princes or kings? They opened the gates to a new way of life and all of the wonder it brings. Once there were founders, both gentle and kind. They gave us this program. It's yours and it's mine. When we came broken, they helped us to mend. I wish they were with us again. So remember the gift from the founders we love, with help from our friends and the power above. Each day we have is a journey begun. I feel they're now with us again. Yes, I feel they're now with us again. Thank you.